welcome to New Books in Religion. I'm your co-host, Hilary Kale. Blood. It's more than a thing and more than a metaphor. It's an effective concept, an element with which and through which Christianity becomes what it is. Western Christianity, if there is such a thing as Christianity singular, embodies a deep hemophilia, a love of blood, even a hematology, a theology of blood that divides Christianity from itself. Theology from medicine, finance from politics, religion from race, among innumerable other permutations. This is the claim of Gil Anajar's recent book, aptly titled Blood, A Critique of Christianity. It is a wide-ranging, challenging book, at times searing and at times poetic. I am so pleased to welcome Dr. Anajar. Welcome, Professor Anajar.
Hi, Harry. Thank you for having me on this program.
Thank you for being here. So I want to begin our discussion by way of asking you a bit about yourself, as we often do on NBIR. What drew you to study religion?
Oh, that's a great question. I find myself thinking that I have changed very little since I was even a child. I can't think of a moment when I wasn't concerned with things that I only later realized were called religion. I think I've always tried to figure out what the difference is, in fact, between what I understood to be my religion, something that I never thought of calling my religion. It was just something I was, whatever I understood at different times by it, from other things that appear to bear, or later I learned, were bearing the same name. You know, one of my favorite moments coming to the United States was to go to a bookstore and find that religion and philosophy were one and the same thing, you know, in bookstores, religion, philosophy, spirituality. And I thought, well, that makes sense, but it also totally doesn't. And so I've been interested in philosophy. I've been interested in history. I've had the fortune to have teachers who have, been kind of polymath themselves. And also interested in numerous things of that order. And religion, for some reason, feels like one of those kind of meta category that can bring pretty much anything you want underneath. And it's a great object to criticize. It's a great object to think with, as they say. So even though I always feel a little weird saying like, well, yeah, I'm a scholar of religion. But then I feel weird when I say I'm a literary critic. I mean, my PhD is in comparative literature. I certainly feel very strange saying I'm a historian, although I was trained by amazing historians. So I'm not completely comfortable with any of the kind of professional affiliations, but I'm excited by all of them. So, you know, in different ways, and sometimes also angry about all of them, but that's, you know, something else.
And I think that excitement and anger, I would venture to say, really comes out in this book, as well as you were just saying, sort of the categories that we might not think of as religious, but that offer something important to think with.
Right.
So how did you come to this project then, in particular, Blood?
So two things. One is that I realized that almost since the beginning of my academic writing career, Christianity has been very, very important, at first as a kind of obstacle. I started working on medieval Spain, and there were all kinds of interferences. I mean, historically, of course, Christianity runs a major interference between Jews and Muslims, if you want, with the Reconquista, you know, the reinsertion of Spain into Christian Europe. At the level of categories, you know, categories that we wield with relative ease, like mysticism or philosophy or literature. And when speaking about the Middle Ages, these were categories that just made no sense, as far as I could tell. So at first it was kind of a weird interference. And then I was also interested in the particularity of the Jewish-Muslim, the Arab-Jewish connection, for which at least in recent history, or at least so it seemed at the time, Christianity was also running kind of interferences in the way in which we think, oh, you know, Israel-Palestine, that's such a old enmity and which Christianity has nothing to do with, presumably, except, of course, that's, you know, easily recognizable as not quite being the case. By the time I finished my PhD and started working more directly on Derrida, on questions of Jewish Muslim symbiosis, or however we want to call it, Christianity really came kind of center stage for me as a problem. And so by the time Blood appeared, I'll tell you how in a second, it became clear that that was going to be a book that was going to be explicitly about Christianity as a question. And I, you know, half jokingly, that's the way I start the book. I half jokingly said, you know, we've had the Jewish question. We've had the Muslim question. It's still, you know, ongoing. We've had the woman question, the Eastern question, but we haven't really had a Christian question in the sense that, is it time now to finally ask? I mean, of course, as you pointed out, if I say Christianity in the singular, a lot of people are going like, well, what are you talking about? But part of the problem is really, even if we're going to say there are many Christianities, we still have to think them under a particular heading, which in itself does not, bears a whole lot of, inquisitions, if I may use the term, or inquiries that we haven't yet conducted, or at least not sufficiently so, to my mind. I'm struck, for example, that by the fact that the anthropology of Christianity is a kind of new development. How is that possible? Christianity is not a new development. Of all the anthropological objects, Christianity should not have come so recently. What is Christianity? What do we mean when we say, oh, there are many, or it's a religion just like any other? But Blood came by, as pretty much everything I have been doing for now more than 20 years, by Wolf Derrida, who was interested in the figure of the Marano, being the name that was given a derogatory name that was given to conversos, to people who had, for the most part, forcefully converted, or whose ancestors were said to have converted to Christianity in, again, medieval Spain. And Derrida deploys the figure and does all kinds of interesting things. But as I sat down to actually write something on him and the figure of the Marano, I realized that stuff I had learned when I was an undergraduate kind of came back. And the question became, when Christians decided that some people who were thought to have converted, or who had in fact converted, or whose ancestors had converted, when time came to actually decide that these were not quite good people, right, or not Christian enough, the thing they attached themselves to in order to make that claim was blood. They decided that their blood, those conversos people, was not pure. And that struck me at that moment as a very, very strange idea. I mean, you could make the argument in any number of ways. You could just say, well, look, we don't like them, or they were Jews, or they were Muslims, so we just don't want them in. You didn't have to actually engage in a theologically problematic claim, namely that the waters of baptism do not work. Their blood doesn't change. Now, why their blood? Like, you could even say all of them don't change, right? They as beings do not change. Baptism doesn't work on them, which would have been theologically strange enough. But why blood? And then suddenly a kind of incredible window opened as to how much blood there is, in fact, around us still. And it's the fact that that so much blood continues in modernity. Examples like jus sanguinis, the fact that citizenship in so many states is defined in relation to this thing that presumably comes from Roman law, but in fact doesn't. The term does, but not the significance. Things like blood is thicker than water. Things like kinship and consanguinity, you know, blood banks, yeah. And the fact that blood became the first kind of human biological commodity. So many things where blood seemed so very important today. And when looking at people like Michel Foucault, who makes an argument, in fact, for modernity as something that takes its distance from blood, right? Blood being signified as an archaic thing, an archaic remnant. It became kind of puzzling because there is a lot of blood. The blood of race is the most obvious, but also the blood of nations. I just started becoming very puzzled, and quickly things, three concepts kind of emerged as nation, state, and capital. So nation as a community, state as a set of institutions and capital as the economy. And it turned out that blood was figuring, in fact, in a very, very strange manner in those three terms. Again, the nation as the community of blood, the state as a body politic that is very strangely void of blood in most representations that I found, and money as the blood of the state, money as that which circulates, that which feeds the body politic. And so it became a kind of way of making an argument because, of course, I then went on to try to demonstrate, I think I kind of did, that the importance that blood took within the Christian world, obviously because of the blood of Christ, obviously because of the blood of relics, but also because of a kind of synergy of Greek medicine and debates within the church, the revival of Roman law, all those things kind of came together. And so blood kind of exploded in its symbolic, material, philosophical, conceptual importance. And so I just basically started having fun in trying to follow it. And it took me to places I never thought I would go, like back to ancient Greece and all the way to, you know, modern America, by way of Melville and the one drop rule and all kinds of, blood quantum, you know, the way Native Americans were and still are categorized in American law. So it just became like a trip, you know, and it also became a way of trying to map out what seemed to me to be a kind of Christian space where the singular importance of blood, which of course is important in every culture, but not in this way, not in everything, not in law, economics, and politics, and medicine, and philosophy, and literature, everywhere.
So I want to ask you more specifically about those three categories that you were talking about: nation, state, and economy. But first, I think that maybe it would be helpful for listeners who haven't actually read the book yet to step back for a moment, and maybe you could give us a sense of, in the Greek period, as well as in the Hebrew biblical text, which you talk about in the book, that blood actually is not this natural concept the way that we might think. So you help to denaturalize it. What does it look like in that early period before the concept itself sort of explodes in the Middle Ages?
Thank you. I'm very grateful for the question because, of course, every time I say, look, there's something peculiar about Christianity's relation to blood, even though we all know about the importance of the blood of Christ, right? Even in, and I want to say almost, especially now in Protestant theology, evangelical, etc., the question is invariably, yes, but I mean, all cultures care about blood. I mean, look at the Aztecs and blood sacrifices and look at the Bible. And the thing is that I tried, in fact, to stay away from, for the most part, from sacrifice, menstruation, and murder. Because the association between those three themes, let's say, and blood is quasi-universal. I mean, often it involves blood specifically. Not every sacrifice is bloody, but the association between blood and sacrifice is fairly strong. Menstruation and blood, obviously, even though that too, cross-culturally, it's a complicated issue. And then murder. Obviously, not every murder is bloody, but we understand the connection. And then there's the more general issue of how the body and body elements provide a resource for thinking. Again, cross-culturally. But I wanted to look at what was more specific. Now, when you look at the Hebrews, at the ancient Hebrews and at the Greeks, you find, of course, murder, menstruation, and sacrifice. And blood is fairly important. Now, what has been interesting is to realize that although the Bible is, in fact, much more minimalist than we think when it comes to blood, in other words, blood is much more contained, the amount of work of scholarship for the past two centuries that deal with blood in ancient Israelite religion is staggering. The amount of work on the Greeks and blood is, for some reason, not as much. Now, anybody who has read the Iliad or the Odyssey, for that matter, is aware of the fact that blood is a pretty important figure, right? So it's not like there's much doubt, but of course we're dealing with war, And then we're dealing with strange things like Odysseus going down to Hades and having to feed blood to the dead so that they can be somehow revived and actually interact with him. So there's a nice like vampiric moment. So there are all kinds of weird things. And in fact, the Greeks, ancient Greek philosophers, for example, and I call them philosophers because that's what they were, but they were also, of course, physicians at the very same time for most of them, and natural scientists and geographers and whatever else, actually thought of blood as quite important. You know, you have those amazing statements from pre-Socratic philosophers, everything is water or everything is air. And I even found one who said more or less everything is blood. But that is not so very frequent. And still there is a kind of intense reflection on blood. And of course, tragedies, Oedipus, is an obvious place to look. And yet, even though there is a lot of blood, at no point does it become so very extensive as to, for example, be equated with identity, with citizenship, with the economy, whatever that might have been at the time, yes. And even in the case of embryology, where only Aristotle, in fact, appears to have been hematocentric, in claiming or in seeming to claim that what is passed on from the parent to the child is blood, with Aristotle, who was, of course, completely phallocentric and only thought that the father was a parent. Even in this case, the transmission of some kind of essence from the father, who is the real parent, to the child actually does not happen through blood. So that things that we attribute to the Greeks, like flesh and blood, or to the Hebrews, like flesh and blood, to the Greeks, like consanguinity and kinship, or to the Hebrews, like the notion of flesh and blood, happen to not be there at all. The Hebrew Bible never mentions the phrase flesh and blood. It's flesh and bone, as we know. Now, you could say, well, that doesn't make that much of a difference. But bone has never become so very important. The flesh, it's more complicated. But again, that's an issue. You know, here's my flesh, here's my blood. That's something that becomes very, very important later with Christ and with interpretation of the New Testament, which is when the Eucharist kind of comes in, when questions of the relics come in. So that even with the ancient Hebrews, even with the ancient Greeks, blood, as important as it undeniably is, never pervades everything. And that's the major difference that I see between Christianity and pretty much everything else. Now, that's not quite a definition of Christianity, but it is a way of trying to kind of get a hold on its expanse, if you want.
As you said before, I mean, something that's so important is that these concepts of, for example, flesh and bone rather than flesh and blood are concepts about relatedness, about kinship, that blood becomes this understanding about kinship in the Middle Ages that doesn't exist earlier, or at least certainly anyway, not to the same degree.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it also acquires a temporality that is very different. Mm. Blood becomes almost eternal. Right? You can trace your bloodline until the beginning of time. In the Bible, flesh and bone is extremely confined to, in fact, to three generations. After that, it becomes something else. You do not trace your flesh and bone more than three generations back. That just doesn't happen. And so blood acquires also this kind of peculiar kind of almost eternity. Which again, I think is very much connected to Christ and the way he is understood, much later than in the New Testament, obviously.
So this really brings us up to the Middle Ages, right? To that period where Christ's blood and where the concept of pure blood, as you were talking about before, right? Sangre limpieza in Spain, becomes so important. And you also mentioned in the book, which I thought was just fascinating, the importance of William Harvey's discovery of circulation of blood,
absolutely,
which becomes this sort of controlling metaphor for how lots of different processes in society, as well as kinship, is thought of. So in that period, then, what you say is so important is not just the idea of blood, although that's important, but the idea of different bloods.
Right.
Now, you touched on this before, but I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about this moment in the Middle Ages, when people start thinking about different bloods.
Right.
How does that come about? What does it look like?
So the narrative that has been more or less accepted, which is the one I kind of had to confront very early on, which really brought me to this whole project, was the notion that there's something kind of special, something kind of crazy about medieval Spaniards, because they had this crazy idea that Jews had impure blood, Jews and or ex-Jews or alleged ex-Jews and Muslims had a different blood. And, you know, this kind of expands into all kinds of crazy things like, oh, well, the Spaniards, you know, they like to kill bulls and they had this crazy empire, which presumably, over against the Protestant empires like the Dutch, the British, the, German, the American, these were the kind empires, as opposed to the Catholic empires that were really, really bloody. I love that one because it's so ludicrous that you don't even know from where you should actually be looking at it. But the fact is that there is this thing that, you know, Catholics, Spaniards are particularly obsessed with blood. And so they came up with this crazy idea in the Middle Ages, which may or may not be the origin of modern racism. But that's the extent of the discussion. And I really wanted to, I have a friend who jokingly, said that I was an apologist for the Inquisition because I tried to de-exceptionalize the Inquisition, which doesn't mean to exonerate it, but does mean that there wasn't something so very peculiar about the Spaniards in making this argument about the limpieza de sangre. But really what had happened is that Christians in the Middle Ages with the dissemination of the Eucharist, as a sacrament, which is, you know, 13th century, there was, you know, something that I think should probably be called the disciplinary revolution, whereby Christians, by ingesting the blood of Christ, started thinking of their own blood as different. And I think this is really the key, that the moment you ingest the blood of Christ in the form of wine, which is also a kind of intoxicant, so it's a physical feeling that one acquires once a week, once a month, once a year. It doesn't really matter how often they actually did it or how rarely. The fact is that there was something that was particularly loaded about this practice, which led Christians to think of themselves as having a different blood. Now, what's interesting is that historians and anthropologists already have argued that it's with the beginning of the Eucharist that accusations of blood libel, namely that Jews, for the most part, were interested in the blood of Christians, emerges at that moment. So that's almost kind of, it's not old knowledge, but it's knowledge that has been around for a few decades at least. And of course, it makes sense. If you drink the blood of Christ, you have a special blood, and those who do not have it might want it. It's the best blood in the world, right?
And that blood libel, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with it.
Blood libel is the accusation of Jews that once a year, at least for Passover, in order to make the matzah, the unleavened bread that Jews eat at Passover, was made with the blood of a Christian child who was kidnapped and bled to death. And so those accusations, of course, of which there were hundreds and hundreds over the course of centuries, were often an opportunity to go and massacre Jews under these accusations. And there's all kinds of interesting things that happened around that. I mean, interesting and dreadful, of course, but including until very recently in the scholarly world. The point, though, is that the argument I ended up making is that in the Middle Ages, through a combination of different things, but primarily, of course, with the consumption of the Eucharist, Christians started thinking that their own blood was different. And so all kinds of kind of symptomatic consequences followed. And one of them was, well, if we have special blood, then they must have non-special blood. Now, in the history of racism, something has not actually registered enough, namely that Jesus, as a figure, as a theological figure, is really the first human being to be granted the notion of having a pure blood. And since his lineage is also at stake, and since his blood is being disseminated in all kinds of ways in the Middle Ages, including by consumption, but also by flowing out of relics, something very different happens then, where not only do we have a special blood, but we also have a pure blood. And so others must have impure blood. And you see that not only in Spain, but you see that in Shakespeare, when Shylock is forbidden from actually touching a blood that apparently is a different blood, namely Christian blood. And that, I think, is the major invention. It's an invention that St. Paul would have, you know, at least rolled his eyes at, and probably much more. But it's something that seems to have happened. And of course, it creates something which I think is historically unprecedented, namely a self-understanding on the part of a community that they are bound to each other by blood and by pure blood. Now, we know that this idea traveled quite far. But the fact that it might find its origin at that particular moment seems to me to require that we change what we think of Christianity as not merely a religion, but also as possibly the religion that became a race, the first pure-blooded community, the first nation, and the first kind of kinship group, which later anthropologists will go on to universalize and, of course, accuse primitive of not being able to transcend. Conveniently enough, right? So that was, and so Harvey is a kind of combination of that process where suddenly he puts the heart, which he discovers is the pump, which feeds the entire body, as really the figure of the sovereign, which, by the way, at that moment can be decapitated without really losing anything because that's not where it's at. It's in the heart. And then everything circulates. It's the origin of all the figures that we are now familiar with of networks, right? It starts with circulation and then it becomes, complex, systems. But circulation as a concept in Marx and everywhere else, really, in urban studies, in economy, everywhere, just completely takes off from that moment. And again, it requires that we think of Christianity as also being a kind of political economy of its own, which then expands and transforms, of course.
One of the things, and maybe this is what your friend was getting at when he called you an apologist for the Inquisition, was something I just found really interesting is that you note that
in
other places...
I can't wait for someone to quote.
Yes.
It's on some website. Gil Anijar said that he's an apologist for the Inquisition. I love that.
I'm sorry. You know, something that you point out in this book is that whereas other states, I mean, England is probably the one that our listeners are most familiar with, but had already expelled their Jews. In some sense, the thing that is different about Spain is that it came late to the game, that it was actually after this notion of blood had really had enough time to percolate. I don't know. I'm trying to think of given the tone of the book, a good liquid expression for what was happening. But after this notion of
coagulate,
yes. After this notion of blood in the Eucharist and Christianity as kinship, in some sense, had coagulated sufficiently that this was the moment that then, of course, in Spain, the kind of violence against both Jews and also nobles broke out, and this concern about purity.
Absolutely, and what's important is not only that Spain, which of course is not Spain, but the Kingdom of Castile and Aragon, etc. Not only does it come late in the game, but it actually comes in a strange way, almost soft in the game, because England, the Kingdom of England, the Kingdom of France, when they expelled their Jews, they didn't give them a choice. Now, you could say, well, what kind of a choice is it? Either convert or leave. I grant that it's not exactly great, but it is a choice. In other words, this is not your life that we will divest you of. We'll renegotiate your belonging. If you want to belong, you have to become like us. Otherwise, out. Now, it's precisely because of that particular opening that then anxiety percolated, as it were, and it became a question of loyalty, a question that was formulated in theological terms. But I do think it's important to remember that at the time, it was a kind of imagine today Spain being accused of being soft on immigration. Right, they were kind of being soft on the Jews because they gave them a choice. They said convert or leave. something which by now, as we know, Europe would like, yes, for Muslims to either become more like Europeans, more secular like Europeans, or not be there at all. Right. So the discourse is complicated because it prefigures all kinds of weird modes of toleration, in fact, under, of course, a general, you know, if it's convert or leave, certainly I would like to have a third option. But at the time, it was still more of an option than other kingdoms had actually given.
Moving a bit closer to us in time, and you've already mentioned a few different figures as you've been speaking. You mentioned Marx, you mentioned Hobbes, maybe not by name, but I know that you were referring to him.
Yes.
So how does then this idea of blood, how does this flow into notions of statehood, nation, and economy, as you've been mentioning, but haven't quite explained for us yet?
Well, so the first notion that actually carries through a kind of originary kinship, which is set up with the Christian people, the populus Christianus, as a community of blood, is that it ends up being transferred to the nation. The nation is a nation of blood, and interestingly enough, since you mentioned the nobility, what happens in Spain, in a way, is actually at that level is on the early side, namely that the nobility does not have a privileged claim to have a special blood. If anything, their blood is tainted, whereas the people's blood is not. Now, one of the material conditions for that is, of course, that the nobility documents its lineage, whereas the people does not. And therefore, it's much easier for a peasant to say that they have pure blood, that they are of good lineage, because there's very few ways of demonstrating otherwise. With the nobility, it was very easy to demonstrate that it was otherwise. And therefore, there was a kind of cutting down to size of the nobility as a privileged group. And later on, you could think of it as a kind of democratization of blood, where the nobility, which claims to have pure blue blood, right, which is another form of the matter, ends up being delegitimated, and it's the people who inherit that purity of blood. We the French, we the Spanish, we the British have our community of blood. Now, of course, the figure of the state is that as a political figure, as political philosophers in modern times will go on to attribute to Aristotle as well, but that's actually a wrong attribution. So in modern times, politics gets refigured as that which must transcend blood, right? So on the one hand, we are a nation of blood, but then it becomes kind of politically incorrect, particularly, of course, in the Republican tradition. But the figure of the state, Leviathan, right, of the body politic, remains very bodily, whether it's mechanical or organic is less important than the fact that it is figure as this machine, body, of which Hobbes, of course, is the best-known representative. And the place of blood in all this is kind of both essential, because it is the multitude, the community, and on the other hand, marginal, because the state is apparently free of it. And that's the interesting thing, is that it's that freedom from blood which marks the passage from tribal, you know, communal politics to real politics, which is free of blood. And as we know, that's not really the way it happened. But as a kind of theoretical discourse, the nation as a community of blood was very important. And of course, it does lead to racism. With all due respect to Benedict Anderson, who claims that there's a fundamental distinction between racism and nationalism, I don't think it's the case. I'm certainly not convinced by the evidence. So that's for nation and state, right? The state being the bloodless representation of a community that is in itself conceived of as a blood community. Now, Hobbes is the one who also makes the articulation to the economy, because he is the one who, in fact, being a friend and a student of Harvey, deploys the notion of blood as money and commerce.
That's circulation.
Exactly. And invokes circulation and sanguification, which Quentin Skinner taught me about this, is a beautiful word of the English language, which means the reddening of the cheeks. So how does Leviathan show up its health? By being, you know, wealthy in commerce and having lots of money circulate. It's a amazing image, which of course also explains why Marx would then go on to say that capitalism is vampirism, right? As Moses Hess, a few years before Marx, actually put it, another early socialist, said in the Middle Ages, they used to drink the blood of Christ and now they drink the blood of the workers. And so it actually, shows, and there are many, many more examples, the way in which blood becomes a kind of, go-to image, figure, symbol, for the economy at large. And it's not determining of all political economy, of course, but it is pervasive and fairly ubiquitous. And so there you have it, right? Nation, state, capital are concepts for which blood, kind of occupies a very important function, and a little too important if it were the case that blood is something that we left behind long ago among those, you know, primitive tribes who didn't know any better. It becomes quite constitutive, in fact, of modern times.
As listeners have probably already gathered, the role of Jews and Jewishness, I mean, I'm now riffing off the fact that you just mentioned Marx, that Jews and Jewishness are very prominent throughout the book, really. Were you aware of that focus when you began, or did that sort of develop as you were writing it? Did you think that you could write this book without any Jewishness in there?
That's very interesting. Is it really that? I've never been asked that particular question. Look, I begin as a scholar of Jews. My training was, you know, in Jewish history and in Jewish philosophy at first. It kind of then expanded in a somehow uncontrollable manner, but there's no question that Jewish history, questions of Jewish politics, let's say, and of the Jewish tradition are absolutely essential to my thinking. I didn't realize how ubiquitous I had made Jews in the book. It is true that I realized that when it comes to blood, and particularly to the limpieza de sangre, to the history of Spain and the Inquisition, the focus has been mostly on the Jews, on the victims of the Inquisition. And I very much wanted to shift the focus around, which is why, of course, it's half a play. I wanted to shift the focus from the Jewish question to the Christian question. And so, of course, Jews kind of, because they've been a constant foil for many of the questions that interest me, I suppose they were unavoidable for me to kind of mention. But I think that the, you know, to the extent that I can speak of my intent, it was really to kind of show that they're not the center, even though they may have paid a whole lot of the price of those developments. This is not where my focus actually was. I really wanted to show that it is Christians over the course of the centuries who have changed the way in which they have thought of themselves. And of course, with all kinds of consequences for others, African Americans, slaves. So that the history, of course, is a history of which not entirely, but to a great extent, is a history of prejudice. But I really wanted to make it something else than a history of prejudice. I wanted to make it into a kind of showing that there's this element with which Christians appear to have thought themselves and made themselves in a way that goes way beyond prejudice, and that goes way beyond what we tend to think of as religion, but really kind of sets up a field that involves religion and politics and science and race and economy and law. So really quite a wide array of things that we tend to think of today as distinct, if not utterly separate, but at least distinct. And I wanted to show that their indistinction is still actually with us.
Two of the figures who you focus on, Marx and Freud, will be well known to all of our listeners, I'm sure. And as you mention in the book, are often studied either as Jews or as sort of self-hating Jews, we might say. So How do you view them here? How does their work influence?
You know, at some point I couldn't help it. It's somewhere between the passion, what I hope is a sense of humor, and the anger. I had to quip that if someone today says, well, you know, Marx, Spinoza, Marx, Heine, and Freud, these were Jews, and that's perfectly okay. Even though one was excommunicated, the other, converted, another, his father converted, so his relationship to Judaism, I'm talking about Marx, is somehow questionable. And then there's Freud, whose relationship to Jewishness was somehow tenuous. Now, of course, it depends what you call Jewishness. And of course, the last intent I have here is to adjudicate on who is and is not a Jew. But I'm fascinated that it's perfectly okay to refer to these great figures, Spinoza, Marx, Freud, as Jews. But if you say Hobbes, Locke, Hume, Heidegger were Christians, not to mention Nietzsche, then you're kind of borderline lunatic. Like, oh, well, what are you saying here? And I'm just curious because the connection between Hobbes and Christianity seems to me much, much stronger than the connection between Marx and Jewishness by any standard and by any definition one might want of either Christianness and Jewishness. So that was the first thing, right? It was a way of turning kind of the mirror. Like, let's not focus so much on the Jews and kind of ask, yes, but what is a Christian and who is one? But when it came to Freud in particular, I really just became fascinated by the fact that he tells this amazing story in Moses and Monotheism, whereby the founder of a religion does not belong to the religion, right? Comes to it as an outsider. He's the founder of that religion, and he is murdered. And for some reason, I thought, I think I heard that story somewhere else. And of course, I'm referring to Jesus, right? The founder of a new religion does not belong to that religion. Jesus was not a Christian. Yes, Jesus was a Jew who founded Christianity. We won't quibble as to how and whether that's the case, but that's certainly the image, right? A founding figure. And that founding figure is killed. And I was shocked to find that I think there's like 1.5 scholars who have pointed to the fact that there's a strange similarity between what Freud does to Moses and what actually the story of Jesus is. And so the Christianity, the Christianness of Moses and monotheism seemed to me so blatant that the fact that it hasn't occasioned as many, you know, volumes upon volumes of the Jewishness of that book, Moses and monotheism, or the Jewishness of Freud, just became kind of almost like a joke. It's like, oh, I see, we're going to pounce on the Jewishness of Freud, but we're not even going to consider his Christianness. And so it became at that point, the last chapter of the book, which is called Jesus and Monotheism, and not Moses and Monotheism, is actually trying to read the very ambivalent, let's say, ways in which Freud relates to Jesus and to Christianity, in fact. And it became also much more important than the way in which he deals with anti-Semitism, which is the place where scholars have paid attention to the to Christianity, and where ostensibly that's where Freud brings it in. But of course, my argument is that the whole book is kind of steeped into a particular understanding of Christianity. One could even argue a very sharp critique of Christianity, at the same time as it is also an extraordinary adoption of the Christian narrative. Right? Because the notion that the community is founded by way of a murder and the murder of a father at that, right? Which is then redeemed by the alleged end of that narrative with Jesus, who's the son who sacrifices himself, right? Or rather the father who sacrifices his son and as such redeems himself and et cetera. The whole narrative actually begins, and Freud says it explicitly, with the Christian notion that the community is founded by way of a murder. I mean, Cain kills Abel and no community is founded. And that's the first murder. Oedipus kills his father and no community is founded. In fact, the community is undone. And yet Freud sticks to the notion in Totem and Taboo that the murder of the father is foundational, when his own knowledge of the sources could have said, well, how about the murder of the brother? How about the murder of the son, right? Isaac, or for that matter, Oedipus, right? Who first is the victim of an attempted murder by his father. If you want to say murder is foundational, fine. But then why only the father? And of course, it only makes sense if you have the Christian narrative in mind, whereby the murder of the father is redeemed by the sacrifice of the son.
Right, and that
and so the whole
community.
Thing becomes a loop.
Right.
Exactly. And so Moses and monotheism is really both a kind of confirmation of that, as well as a critique of that narrative. And it strikes me as a kind of unavoidable reading of that book, which also means, of course, paying more attention to the Christianness of Freud, not so much just as an author, but as this kind of phantasmatic figure onto whom all kinds of modes of Jewishness in all kinds of very interesting ways are projected, while not recognizing that we still have some thinking to do about Christianity, which I think we're not doing enough. We're still thinking with the Jews. Most of my teachers do and have. But I think there's, and I respect them for that, and I've learned, you know, what I could from them. But I think that there's more to say about Christianity, and I think Freud is a great opportunity for that, and so is Marx, of course.
Moving on to another really in-depth reading that you do in this book of another classic piece, in this case of literature. So we talked about Hobbes's Leviathan, but we also have Melville who appears here and who you do a great reading of Moby Dick. And it's interesting because, as you said, I mean, this project really took you to places where maybe you weren't expecting at first. I mean, here we have quite recent American, and recent in the grand scheme of things anyway, American literature. Tell us a bit about your reading of Melville. What did you find there?
The moment I started thinking about Leviathan and the body politic, a friend of mine was really a wonderful scholar who works in France and whose work has been translated, not completely, one of whose books I translated myself, Peter Sandy, who's a philosopher, literary critic, musicologist. Basically told me, look, you've got to read Moby Dick. Now, he wasn't the first person who told me to do so, but when I read his book, I recognized that I needed to read Moby Dick, because the conversation between Hobbes and Melville, which for the most part has not been quite taken up, at least not as much as you would have thought, since the word Leviathan is all over the book, all over Moby Dick. And this within political philosophy is mostly because apparently America is a Lockean country, not a Hobbesian one, which is something that doesn't cease amazing me, given, you know, the permanent state of war that this country has been in for most of its history. But leaving that aside, I recognized that I wanted to translate Sandy's book, and I knew, of course, I couldn't do it without reading Moby Dick. So I did, and I was completely blown away. I mean, first, it's a magnificent text. It's biblical. It's Shakespearean in proportion, and it's really encyclopedic, as of course every critic has mentioned. And what interests me is both the national and international dimension of the book. But then, of course, once I started reading it, is to notice how much blood there is in it. There's been people who've been doing all kinds of interesting work on anatomy and political anatomy in Melville, on race in Melville, on economics in Melville. But the way in which all those are actually tied together ended up being blood. Blood ties race and economy and industry and politics and international law and community and what have you, right? In nomine diaboli, right when Ahab has the harpooners kind of swear their oath, they all dip their harpoons in blood, right? And so it's in the name of the devil, which of course recalls in the name of God. So once the blood kind of jumped at me from the book, it became imperative to write on it. And it was really amazing to realize, for example, that Ishmael goes to sea, among other reasons, to improve his circulation, right? And to see how much concern there is for the blood, like the whale catchers for Melville are the original figure of blood for oil, right? No blood for oil. And Melville actually writes, I mean, it's Ishmael speaking at this point, who basically says, every time you turn on your lamp, which is of course lit with whale oil, every time you turn on your lamp, remember there's the blood of basically a fisherman is in there, right? So that the notion that the blood of the whale is the oil of the lamp, and that the oil of the lamp is the blood of the workers, is also there. And there are hundreds and hundreds of illustrations of the sort in Melville. And so I actually thought that he was summarizing, I mean, I can't decide whether it's megalomaniac or humble on my part to say that I think Moby Dick is the original critique of Christianity, right? It's the book that puts blood at the center of the history of Christianity in all of its dimensions. And it was kind of again another trip to go down this incredible book and just learn so much from it.
You talk about so many other thinkers, theologians, writers. I mean, just for our audience members who haven't read the book, we've got Pope Urban II, Hobbes, as we mentioned, Spinoza, who you mentioned, Shakespeare, who got a quick shout out in our conversation, and that's it. Benjamin as well. I'm really putting you on the spot here, but who did you find most compelling or perhaps surprising as you were working on this book? Whose voice echoes for you?
Of all these writers, I mean, I think I'd have to say Melville. Melville was the one who really... I just didn't expect to see so much, and when I started looking at the literature on Melville, I was surprised by this kind of discrepancy between the ubiquity of blood in the book and the and its almost complete absence. There's in fact a kind of naturalness to it. And saying that, actually, I would say that probably the number two. Is someone who doesn't figure much in the book, but remains for me very enigmatic. And it's this great, linguist, Émile Benveniste, a French, among other things, a French linguist, whom Derrida quotes quite a bit, who really went over the lexicon of kinship, in Greek, Latin, and pretty much all the Indo-European languages. And who never took blood as a technical term. In other words, he explored the entire lexicon of kinship in all of its complexity, which is immense, and yet he never took blood as a term to be interrogated. And that, to me, is absolutely fascinating. And then, of course, the last is some kind of combination between Benjamin and Derrida, which is the in a way the opening chapter, which I by no means claim to have resolved, but I think the centrality of the figure of blood in Benjamin's writing and in the way Derrida picks it up, to me, kind of crystallizes how enigmatic ultimately, right? Because we tend to think, well, blood, of course. I mean, who would not be concerned with blood? Who would not use blood as a symbol? Who would not be concerned about blood spilling? But the level which it has reached, right? And something I didn't mention now in our conversation was that a big preoccupation was the way in which we think or don't think of the relation between blood and politics. I mean, I mentioned it a little bit when speaking about the fact that politics is what we think of as emancipating itself from blood. And that the moment we think of politics and blood together, we immediately have the kind of Nazi associations. But blood and politics in this country, in the United States, is massive. The one-drop rule is, although it's strictly legal history, is not very long. its effective history is much longer. The fact that you could be deemed a black man, a black person, by virtue of some claim that you had any amount, unverifiable, by the way, since there was no way of measuring, of black blood, so-called, has a long, long history in this country, and it is the political history of this country. So the fact that we separate blood and politics, even when it is completely blatant, seems to me to really come and be fully crystallized in the kind of this encounter between Derrida and Benjamin over a reading of this short and enigmatic text that Benjamin wrote, where blood has a kind of disproportionate role, really, but also disproportionately enigmatic. And Derrida picks it up, doesn't really resolve the enigma. In fact, I would say he intensifies it. And so that was also very important to me. But I'd have to put Melville first.
Not in preparation for our talk, but just recently I picked up some of the work of anthropologist Circe Sturm, who works on Aboriginal people in the United States and these questions about law and blood and the way that that works in terms of both cultural identification, but also legal codes and treaties. Absolutely. And all these kinds of things. And so beyond African Americans, although it's a great example, the one drop rule, but certainly, as you mentioned really briefly in passing earlier in our conversation, for any of our listeners who want to get more of a sense of how blood plays out in politics in the United States, thinking about how we define things like being an Algonquin or being a Cherokee.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
I mean, this is a great example of what you've been talking about in terms of that the messiness with which blood still infuses. There's another liquid metaphor, but yeah. You know, still infuses our sense of a body politic as well as a nation.
Absolutely.
So you begin the book by talking about the scraps and then mounds of paper that you had gathered over time, which had then seemed to call forth this book in some sense, almost despite yourself, which I just loved reading that, because it, of course, made me feel very self-righteous about the fact that my desk is a mess. It's just a book that's being called into being clearly. So are you building up new mounds of paper? Anything else in the works that's being called
for? I am, actually. For reasons that are, I think, obvious, there's more and more of us who are worried about the the incessant and exponentially growing expansion of weapons. And I'm not sure exactly where this is going to go, but I've began reading. There's some wonderful and also terrifying work that has been done recently on drones. And I suppose I'm always interested in, you know, political questions of one form or another. And George Orwell somewhere actually asked, is there such a thing as a democratic weapon? And he actually answers in the positive, but he also says, but of course, there are much more tyrannical weapons. And for him, a tyrannical weapon is a weapon that doesn't really, that is either too complicated or too expensive to be wielded by the masses. And so I think Orwell would agree that we live in an age of absolutely tyrannical weapons, weapons that have no, that one cannot protect oneself from. And, you know, so I'm reading Mike Davis on the history of the car bomb, who actually makes a powerful argument for the fact that there might be responses to the most horrifying and tyrannical weapons, but of course still, and perhaps equally tyrannical, right? So Orwell would have to be interrogated under this. But anyway, the general question is, you know, how do we think together weapons and politics? And does it make sense? I mean, the fact that Orwell asked the question of democratic weapons doesn't mean that he's correct. Maybe there is no possibility, and maybe all weapons are tyrannical, in which case I think we should think of our own political beliefs, our own political convictions, particularly our democratic convictions. Perhaps we should think about weapons a little more. And I'm not suggesting, of course, that we don't or that many people haven't. But I'm looking for a way of perhaps exploring this in whatever fashion. So that's it's been I've been accumulating lots of scraps of papers and bounded ones as well.
Well, thank you so much. I'm sure that everyone will continue to follow your work, and they should pick up, of course, Blood, A Critique of Christianity, which just came out recently. So thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you very much for your great questions.